Welcome to the world of the strange, the mystical, and the unknown. Jerry Pippin's Parazone.
What if people could come out of one dimension to another? What if those entities coming out of one dimension to another were horrible? Demons of some sort. Or maybe angelic human beings. Hi, I'm Jerry Pippin. Welcome to the Parazone Hour, Tales of High Strangeness. Vera Yedoza is joining us from New Jersey. She's originally from Turkey and is our expert on the supernatural worldwide. And our guest from Springfield, Missouri is Tom Horn. Actually, he's outside Springfield, a little toward Branson. And he's written a book about Stargate. And in this book, he deals with portals. Portals where either interplanetary beings or perhaps interdimensional beings or beings from hell arrive. Welcome to the show, Vera. Vera Yedoza, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much.
Good. It's great to have you on the UFO Files again. And I know you've lined up Tom Horn for us, and tell us a little bit about that book.
Well, you know what? This is one of the most exciting books that I read recently, and Nephilim Stargate, the year 2012, and The Return of the Watchers by Thomas Horn. We had some emailing with Tom about the book, about Stargate, and this is one of the most exciting topics in UFO field.
Well, we have Tom Horn on the line. Farah is in New Jersey at her home studio. And Tom Horn, you've got a little ranch outside Springfield, don't you?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. In fact, I'm sitting here at my home studio right now, and right outside of this building, not too far from me, are a whole bunch of horses.
Well, that's pretty neat. How far are you from Springfield, 30 minutes or so?
Yeah, you know, I'm actually, I'm not directly between Springfield and Branson, but I'm about 30 minutes from either one of those, kind of at an angle going towards the Oklahoma border.
Yeah, that's pretty country.
It's beautiful out here. We love it.
Farah, you want to start this interview with Tom? You and he have been talking quite a lot.
Yes, we have been talking about the Stargate. We have been talking about this interview, so it is time to start now. So, Tom, thank you very much for being with us tonight. So,
well, thank you for having me on your show, Jerry and Farah.
I have been reading your book again and again, taking notes, because each time that I'm reading, I find more interesting things, more historical things. But first of all, let's start with the title of the book, Stargate. What is a Stargate exactly?
Well, you know, a Stargate actually means different things to different people. And of course, given the fact that you've read my book, you know that I actually offer different descriptions in this book of what a Stargate, is, and I kind of exchange similar terms to Stargates, portals, pathways. The idea to me being that whether we're talking about something that's an advanced science or whether we're talking about something that's metaphysical, it's the concept that there could be a pathway or a methodology by which another intelligence, something not human, would be able to move from its reality into our reality. So let me give you a couple of very quick illustrations about what I mean. Mm-hmm. There are those who are among quantum physicists who see the possibility of stargates or wormholes as being advanced but natural science. And I tell people, you know, right away that I'm not a scientist, I'm a researcher, and so my ability to be able to dialogue about the possibility of things like quantum physics or even Einsteinian physics is very limited. But I do understand some basic things, or I should say I had to make myself study long enough that I understood some basic things, at least from the scientific side, about all of this, where, for instance, the ideal of wormholes. In the 1970s, you had a guy by the name of Alan Holt. He was the first guy that defined what was called the field reconnaissance space-time tunneling, or what today we more commonly refer to as wormholes or stargates. And this is a theory that hyperspace tunnels may actually connect either different remote regions of the universe or different dimensions and or different moments in time. And some people believe that UFOs, if you will, could hypothetically be traveling through these space-time tunnels from incredibly far distances to the Earth or from other parallel dimensions. And that in any case, they might be doing this in matters of seconds or maybe even at speeds greater than light. This was the, you know, this was the theory that was postulated by Alan Holt. It was picked up. A lot of people believe that it's fairly good science. And it's my understanding that recent improvements in our knowledge of general relativity has caused some people to believe that there could be such things as wormholes, and that the manipulators of wormholes or stargates, that is, some unknown advanced super intelligence from perhaps either a different dimension or from some faraway galaxy, that they could be appearing and disappearing through these traversable wormholes, and that because the science is so far above our knowledge, there's just no way for us to comprehend what's going on. We catch glimpses of these UFOs appearing and then disappearing and whatever. Now, that's kind of the, Farah, that's kind of the scientific way of kind of approaching what, you know, what we think might be happening with the appearance and disappearance of the phenomenon that we refer to as UFOs. On the other hand, as you know from reading my book, Nephilim Stargates, the year 2012 and the Return of the Watchers, I believe, like some of, who I believe to be some of the best researchers in this field, and I'm talking about people like Dr. John Mack, Dr. John Keel, Jacques Vallée, those are the secular researchers. There were also religious persons that have approached this study, like Dr. Ida E. Thomas. But the best of all of these have come to believe that, if not entirely, at least in part, part of the phenomenology that is occurring with UFO and even alien abduction phenomena, the rest of it, is spiritual or metaphysical.
Oh, yes. There is a scientific and there is a spiritual side of the UFO cases and alien abduction cases, close encounter cases, that's for sure.
Well, Tom, what do you think? Do you think it's a little of all of it, or is it completely
Well, no,
spiritual?
I believe that there certainly could be both. I mean, I'm a person who believes that we live in a magnificent reality. I mean, the cosmos, you know, like what's his name, used to say, billions and billions,
yeah,
you know, and you know, planets and star systems. And I think it would be folly to think that there's no possibility. And even, and by the way, I don't see a contradiction here with religious faith. People who have faith, most of them now, you've noticed lately, the Catholic Church has very much warmed up to the idea of intelligence, not just the discovery of microorganisms on Mars or that kind of life, but advanced intelligent life. They've warmed up to that. The Muslims are open to that. Many of Earth's religions, including now many of the Christian community, believe that there is this possibility.
Yes, definitely in Islam there is the belief for the other dimensions, other beings living in other planets. It is in Quran. And also Sufism, the esoteric part of Islam, definitely accepts the existence of the beings from the other planets.
When we talk about all of this, Tom, and when you wrote this book, did you have a predetermined idea about stargates? I mean, you know, I think of when I think of stargates, I think of maybe some science fiction writer like Robert A. Heinlein many years ago writing about it, or perhaps more recently Star Trek. What was the hot button here that got you interested?
Well, you know, the irony behind all of this, Jerry, is that I was not a fiction writer. I wrote nonfiction. I was also a freelance writer, and I had gigs where I was doing writing for some of the largest newspapers in the United States. And I had no interest, by the way, at the time, in looking into this material. Although I will admit, and Farrell would know this since he's read my book, that there was some experiences that were going on in my family as I was growing up.
Oh, yes.
That I couldn't comprehend. Later on, I went into seminary. I got a PhD, and I actually earned an honorary doctorate also for my study in ancient biblical literature and Eastern literature. I have very good friends like Dr. Mike Heiser, who can actually interpret 7 extinct languages. But that was kind of the circle that, if you will, I hung out in. That's my background. But at the time, I was doing research. In fact, I'll be honest with you, I can't remember what I was doing research on. I was writing an article for one of the major U.S. newspapers. But I came across the term called transgenics. And at that time, Jerry and Farah, I had never heard this term.
Well, yeah, transgenic as in abductions or hybrids?
No. Transgenics as in a new emerging field of science.
Okay, you just want to make this clear for our listeners.
Yeah, you know, and here's what struck me odd that year, and I'll make this fast because I want to get back on the subject. That year, according to this article that I had come across, fully one-fourth of all federal research grants in the United States was going toward funding transgenic research, and the military had a strong interest in this, and I looked up the term very quickly and found out that it had to do with the mixing of living species, the crossing over of species, blending one species with another. Now, today, we're doing this all over the world, at the embryonic level at least, and many people suspect much higher than that, perhaps in black budgets and in military laboratories, but at least at the embryonic level now, routinely, we are cross-blending humans with animals. And at the time that I came across this, I was astonished that as a taxpayer, fully one-fourth of whatever taxes I was paying that were going towards research were being given that year, and this was about 14 years ago maybe, towards transgenic research. So I wanted to do a lot of research into this and find out what it was we were paying for that, you know, we didn't even know what was going on. And to make this story quick, you know, I did some research. I wrote a couple of editorials. One of them received fairly wide distribution. And out of the blue, I was contacted by Cal Thomas, the syndicated columnist for the L.A. Times.
Right, and where of him?
Yes, and he was blown away by the research that I had done. And I had thought, man, you know, if Cal Thomas, who kind of lives in the news, isn't even familiar with what I'm talking about, and I wasn't familiar with it either, and I was a researcher, I had the suspicion that most people, and when I say most, I mean the vast quantity of people who were taxpayers, had no clue what we were funding. And so I just started doing a lot of research into it, but here's the crux. I wanted to know what these scientists had to say about, you know, what might be the ethical questions about crossing the species barrier, what might be the philosophical questions, that side of it. But I also wanted to know if they had any concerns about throwing off the balance of nature. Because what we were talking about now, if you were a religious person, then this did not comply with, you know, creation. Whoever your God is or whatever your belief system is, this was not something that the Creator had made. Well, also, if you had no religious faith, this was also not something that evolution had allowed for. And it's so that in either of these cases, I felt that we were talking about something now, you know, like we've already seen, you know, in genetically modified crops, that they could do things that we're not prepared for, because we know that genes, we study gene models based upon their natural host. But when I've had molecular biologists tell me that when you start transporting a gene from one host to a blended host or another host, it might behave in an entirely different way. So in other words...
Yeah, you're talking about unintended consequences.
Unintended consequences, and I wanted to know what these scientists were saying, where we should be cautious. You know, what would be the benefits of this? And I do think there are benefits to biotechnology, but what might also be some of the concerns? And here, let me get back on track. Here's what happened. Because we were kind of riding the bicycle while we built it, I mean, there, you know, the science was so new and advancing so quickly that we didn't have any field models that had been done to tell us, you know, what we ought to be concerned about. And scientists were being very careful about what they might speculate about because they didn't want the public to, you know, be alarmed about it. And so, I could not find any models in the scientific community about what might happen between the blending of humans and animals, but I kept coming across, and Vera, this of course will take us back to the book, I kept coming across this ancient story where it sounded to me like something like this had happened once before, where the gods had come down. And this was a story that was told literally in every society where they were advanced enough to be able to make records of their history. Whether they chiseled it in stone or wrote it on animal hides, there was this story where the gods came down, the super intelligences came down, and for some reason they wanted to blend, they wanted to mingle their species with the human race. They wanted to create for themselves a body into which they could extend themselves. And for some reason, it seemed to require the need to blend different species in order, you know, animals and humans and even plants, according to some records, in order to create something into which they could download themselves or upload themselves or whatever term you want to use. But I saw this as the first record of transgenic science. And it started sounding to me like what for many years I had only thought of as being mythology. You know, Zeus comes down, marries a human woman, or blends with her, out of which Hercules, a mighty man of old, was born. But this story was being told over and over. I found ancient records like an apocryphal book called Jasher. And this is a very old book. It's actually referred to in Old Testament books of the Bible, like Joshua and 2 Samuel, though it's not part of the Bible. But this Jasher had recorded how that after these beings came down and used humans and animals for creating themselves a body, this is in the fourth chapter of the book of Jasher, if somebody wants to read this, that after that, men began teaching the blending of species of one kind of an animal with another kind of an animal, and that they were creating this exotic offspring, and that it actually had led to chaos. And so I started running into all these records, and I thought, you know, the thing that we have thought of for so long that as being a record of mythology, maybe this was a record that was made to warn us that certain sciences might be catastrophic. Because you know how our records really only go back to about the Sumerian Empire. We don't know very much beyond the Sumerians. The Sumerians seem to appear almost overnight, just all at one time. They're there, and now we have history, and out of that comes Abraham and all these various religions. But we do have artifactual evidence all over the world that seems to attest that the Earth itself had highly intelligent civilizations that date back eons, who knows how far back, but that something catastrophic occurred. And this was that record, Jerry and Farah, this was that record that just astonished me, that I seem to be finding where once before an intelligence had an interest in blending species.
We're talking with Tom Horn, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but you've got to take a commercial break, Tom. When we come back, I want to pick this up, and Farah, I'm sure you have some questions about it. And
Yes, I have many questions, in fact.
And I want to get to some examples of this, Tom, and I think you're about ready to get there.
Sure.
We'll be right back. I'm Jerry Pippin, along with Farah Yaduza. And all of our shows on the Parazone Hour, Tales of High Strangeness, are available on demand 24/7 as a podcast or Windows download, and it's free. Just click on the Parazone button on the sidebar of our website, jerrypippin.com. I'm Jerry Pippin, Farah Yaduza. Tom Horn's book again. Tom, the name of it for our listeners is?
Nephilim Stargates is the main title, the subtitle, The Year 2012 and the Return of the Watchers.
You know, Farah, I've done a lot of shows about the Nephilim.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Over time. In the Mideastern legends and religions, anything like that happening there too?
A lot. Tom was talking about Sumerian civilization, and a similar thing happened on Turkish territory, Turkish land. we have the Hittites, Hittite civilization. Hittites were a very, very mysterious race as well. And we really don't know about their background, where did they come from, we don't know. But historians and archaeologists believe that they came from the north. And they came to Turkish land, and they immediately changed everything on Turkey, in ancient Turkey, and Hittites became the first official government system, first official kingdom on Turkish land, same. And they have so many gods who came from the sky, and lots of contacts with the sky beings. It is the almost the same story.
Tommy, I know you've got a degree in divinity, right?
Yes.
But these things happened in other religions besides Christianity, as you alluded to earlier.
Yes, absolutely they did. In fact, what I found was that in every major civilization. So whether we're talking about the Sumerians, the Amorites, the Babylonians, the Greek Empire, the Egyptian Empire, you can actually find the record of what happened with these gods who came down, blended themselves with humanity, out of which this unusual offspring was born. That these things walked around on the earth, and in many cases, including in the Bible, not just the Bible, that they walked on the earth and they actually ruled kingdoms. And these beings were powerful. Some were giants, like you talked a minute ago. You mentioned the Nephilim, the giants who walked upon the earth. We've recovered either entire skeletons down through time or portions of skeletons that show us that some of these beings were somewhere around, you know, as high as 23 feet tall. Now,
really?
Yes. The Book of Enoch, according to the Book of Enoch, if we interpret the Book of Enoch correctly, some of these beings were as high as 200 feet tall, but we've never found anything to substantiate that. But we have found remains in various parts on the earth that seem to tell us that some of these things were extraordinarily large. How I went from, though, the study of all these different ancient mythologies. And you should understand, too, Farah and Jerry, when I was, when I came out of seminary as a young seminary student, I, of course, had the answers to all mysteries on earth. But
where did you go to seminary?
Well, actually, I'm not going to say.
Okay.
I'm not going to say, and I also won't say what denomination I was part of for almost 30 years as an executive.
Well, a lot of my relatives are ministers. So.
Well, I'm not saying it because I'm ashamed. I don't want to be stereotyped, and I've found, you know, often that people who...
Yeah, all I have to do is mention that some of my relatives are fundamentalist ministers, and they stereotype me that way.
So I learned a long time ago, just, you know, leave that side out of it, just keep it in research. But here's something that extraordinary that happened. My research into these stories, before I wrote the book, Nephilim Stargates, by the way, what had happened was I actually wrote a novel. My wife and I wrote a novel called The Ahriman Gate as a novel.
Oh, yes, yes.
There's actually a movie deal on this now. It's going to be made into a movie. It's going to be a pretty big movie. They have a $50 million budget.
That's big.
This is a done deal. I mean, money has already changed hands. We've already been paid. It's been worked through our attorneys. But when I was doing the research behind the book, The Ahriman Gate, there were parts of that that included trying to understand, you know, the legends behind the Nephilim. The possibility, you know, in part of the book talks about how there's a rogue presence of the government that has come across information on how to resurrect the ancient Nephilim, and so they're doing that. Well, I had to wrap my head around how all of this would happen. I had to understand biotechnology, cloning, transgenics, all that. So, you know, it took me a long time. Well, at the end of it, I wound up with probably 1,600 pages of research material. And so I decided to write the Nephilim Stargates as nonfiction. And Farah, you might get a kick out of this. I actually wrote that book in 90 days. In 3 months.
It's amazing.
It was the fastest thing I ever wrote. I do intend to go back and actually write an improved version that's going to be about 200 pages longer that has a bunch more information in it. But anyway, what happened, though, while I was doing this research, did not believe that there was anything to this whole story about, you know, the Nephilim and the giants walking upon the earth, and I didn't believe that at all. And somebody told me one time, you know, that this story in Genesis 6 was a story about the Watchers, who Enoch had talked about, an extra-biblical book. Well, I should say at one time it was part of the Bible, but it was later expunged. But an apocryphal, a pseudepigrapha book, talking about these 200 very powerful angels that came down and blended humans and animals and made these bodies. Jude and Peter, by the way, in the New Testament, refer to them, those angels which get not their first estate. They wanted to leave their plane of existence, bottom line. They needed a portal. They needed a pathway. They needed a methodology by which they could leave their reality and come into our three-dimensional reality. I didn't believe any of that. And what happened was, as I was studying some 10 years ago to write this Ahriman Gate, the longer I studied, the more I came to believe that there really was something there. And I'll tell you how I became convinced. Because the story was so repetitive. It's like sitting in a court of law and hearing an attorney repeat eyewitness accounts. And they're repeating eyewitness accounts from people all over the world who are telling the same story. Now, each of them are telling it in their own way, and each of them are interpreting what it means in their own belief system. But the bottom line were, the facts on the ground were the same. And the fact that this was everywhere from China to, you know, to American Indians to the Middle Eastern, the fact that around the world this story had been told, literally it convinced me like an attorney would that you couldn't discount this many different eyewitnesses telling the same story that this event had actually occurred. And then one other thing that happened, and this was a surprise. I'm doing this research right into these humans and animal DNA harvesters, if you will, and it took a surprising twist when suddenly I started coming across a related phenomenon, something occurring in modern times called alien abduction. And I found that this need to blend humans and animals, or harvest DNA, if you will, from humans and animals, and sometimes even plant material being changed, like in these, what do they call them, crop circle areas, I started finding that there was something very similar in contemporary society, the removal of human and animal DNA in these UFO flap areas, what Jacques Vallée had called vital energy, matter associated with three-dimensional life forms, which he believed was being required as a kind of construct material for achieving incarnation by other dimensional beings. So I ran into this extraordinary thing that whether I was looking at ancient history, comparative religion, comparative mythology, alien abduction, there was this universal testimony from literally tens of thousands of people from the beginning of known time saying that some type of super intelligence had an interest in collecting and blending Earth species, not just humans but animals. You go to bed one night, you wake up the next day, and Skippy the horse is laying out in the middle of the field, and portions of its anatomy, its muscle mass, its blood have been removed with laser-like precision. And extraordinarily, you know, there's no blood laying around it. It doesn't seem to have put on any kind of a struggle, but there's no evidence of any chemicals that has been anesthetized. And it's laying in the field, and this material has been harvested. Most people don't realize. Now, I know that you do, Jerry, and Farah, you do, but most people in the world don't realize that this has literally happened tens of thousands of times down through time, including thousands of times just in the modern era. And so far, all of the intelligence agencies in the world have not found or tracked down, you know, the international blood-sucking cult that's doing this around the world. It's a true phenomenon. It continues to occur. It's not just animals. Sometimes humans are found with pieces of their anatomy missing. Down through time, different names have been attributed to those who take DNA. Satan, the devil, Lucifer, Zeus, Hades, the Watchers. Enoch talks about the Watchers, but in the seventh chapter of the Book of Watchers, he talks about how they sinned against the animals in the same way they sinned against the humans. So this was just this extraordinary record. And, of course, you know, in my books, I also go into what we're doing now in modern science, the blending of humans and animals, and I say to people, you know, that you have to admit that even if all of these ancient stories of lore were nothing more than fiction or myth, which I don't believe, but if that's the case, the metaphorical resemblance to parts of what they did with modern biotech today, where we're blending humans and animals, is extraordinary. And in any case, it was the most interesting discovery for me to start out studying modern biotechnology, especially things like transgenics, and then to find this story in ancient history, and then if you include ufology and alien abduction, perhaps nonstop down through history there is a record of these beings cross-blending species and animals, and at least in some records, for the purposes of creating a body into which they can extend themselves into our reality.
Tom Horn is our guest. Vera Yudoza is here, and she has several questions for Tom coming up after this message. Don't go away. Variety radio at its best can be found on our website, jerrypippin.com. JerryPippin, all one word, P as in podcast. Hundreds of hours available anytime for free. JerryPippin.com. Tom Horn is here, an incredible book, Tom, and you say you're going to write 200 more pages to it?
By the end of summer next year, I'm at 3,500 pages of research right now, and somehow I have to try to get this down, you know, to less than 500 pages.
Oh, let's talk about the movie as well. It is very interesting. The movie?
What's that?
Ahriman Gate. You said that there will be a movie from your book, Ahriman Gate.
Yes, that.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, that deal has already been done. They've said that I can't talk about it yet.
Oh, yes. I see.
I wanted to publish a press release through Raiders News Network, my news service.
And that's a very good service, by the way.
Well, thank you.
And you interviewed some nice people in Roswell, including me.
It was a pleasure to do so. Well, and Vera, too.
Oh, yes. It was a great interview. It was,
by the way, I'm really, as I understand it right now, the two of you won't be able to be at Burlington, which I'm disappointed. I was hoping to be able to...
But you're going to be speaking at the Vortex Conference.
Right.
And we're doing a show with Mary Sutherland next week as well, going over all of the Vortex Conference. Budget concerns... they kind of locked us out. But I think it's going to be a successful conference in Farron next year.
Yes, I guess. It is going to be a very good...
We'll get our fee.
Well, if you get, you know, all you have to do is get to be as cheap as I am, and then it works out.
Well, I mean, it is impossible for me to drive from New Jersey to there. The only way is...
Well, with the airlines the way they are these days, we weren't asking for a lot of money.
Right, I understand.
No, it was just a matter of cost of transportation. Okay, Farah, you have some things I know you want to talk to Tom about, so I'll turn it over to you for a minute.
Oh, okay. So, Tom, we can listen to you forever. That's so interesting. That's so amazing. But, of course, I have so many questions. So, first of all, going back to Stargate, you say that Stargate can be a physical or a spiritual dimension. That's interesting, first. And the second thing is that if we go back in time, so what was the first beginning of a Stargate? Was it artificially created, or is it a natural part of the universe?
Well, I think that now, as far as being... natural part of the universe, you know, that's a question, Farah, I've never had asked before. I would assume that maybe that might bridge into the idea of it being metaphysical. In other words, that it is a natural part, but it's a part that we have a difficult time adapting our minds to. You know, one of the things that I found, like with Dr. John Mack, and you know, that when he was still doing his research, he interviewed thousands of abductees.
Yes.
And he talked about how, you know, based on redundant records, how that the people that he was interviewing talked to him about how these alien beings seem to come to us, you know, first of all, from the sky in their strange spacecraft, but how that both they and these spacecraft presented kind of a confusing challenge because they seem to partake of properties that belong to both the spirit and the material world.
Yes.
He said that, I'm trying to remember if it was his book, Abduction, and I believe that was the book, and he talked about how that these beings, on the one hand, they were seen by the abductees who could feel their bodies being moved, and they would actually have these small lesions that were inflicted upon them. So that this is trace evidence, or physical evidence, if you will. But on the other hand, he said that these beings seem to be coming. In fact, he actually used the terminology like intermediaries from God or the devil.
How would we know if they are coming from the God or if they are coming from the evil or devil forces? Is it possible to know?
Mac was making the point that there was no way to know. He was simply saying that the phenomenon seemed to match the ancient stories of the succubi and the incubi and sieves and biblical demonology.
Yes, we have the jinns in Turkish and Islamic tradition. We call them jinns.
Jinn, that's right.
Jinn. I mean, in Turkish and Islamic and pre-Islamic, before we became Islam, we were a shamanic society, Turkish society, Turkish race. And before Islam, we believed jinns, that they were interdimensional beings, but they were able to spend some time with us, with humans, in our physical dimension. So they always existed in history, in time, under different names.
Yes, and that under the right circumstances, they have a method by which they can move through their reality and enter into our reality. In fact, Dr. John Mack, I like his term, he actually called it an awkward joining of two species. But Mack, if you read his research, I'm only using him because I could use many others and I don't want to, you know, just get lost in all this research. He also talked about this in Stargate terminology or portal terminology. He talked about how that many of the abductees had spoke to him of their sense, that at least some of their experiences were not even occurring within the physical space-time dimensions of the universe as we comprehend it, but that these beings were coming through from another dimension, a slit or a crack in some sort of barrier, some gateway, some portal. Somehow they were coming from their reality into our world from beyond the veil. One of the most interesting parts of his research had to do with people who did not have high educations and some who had no education, meaning that they didn't have the cerebral training to be able to describe quantum physics or things like that, but that some of those same people who had little education to prepare them to talk about these abstractions, these odd dislocations in scientific terms, had actually talked about, had used words that described a collapse, if you will, of space-time that occurred during their experiences, that they were experiencing these aliens, their abductors, as happening in another reality, although one that was just as powerful or real to them as the familiar physical world, but that they used language that to him came across as being identical to what people of very high education explaining quantum physics, portals, pathways, some methodology by which you could move through one reality into another. You also have people like Jacques Vallée, who I very much appreciate his research, and as you know, in my book, quoted him quite often. Talking about how these ultra-terrestrials...
Oh, yes, it's another very important subject, in fact, ultra-terrestrials.
How that they were actually harvesting matter, and then they would manipulate animal, plant, atmospheric molecular energy.
Energy vampires.
You're kind of like an energy Dracula.
How do we even know where the ancient stories of the vampires came from?
Well, I've always suspected there's more to that than meets
the eye. I think that it is related to extraterrestrials because, yes, they come from
the... They walk up and down walls. I mean, they can do things, and they seem to come through windows. You notice that? Dracula. He comes through windows. Well, that's exactly what the aliens do, some of them.
Shape-shifting. Also shape-shifting. Dracula shape-shifts.
Shape-shifting.
Yes.
And they have an interest in draining blood.
Draining the energy and using hypnosis in order to control the victim, which basically Grace do that.
Well, Tom and Farrah, are we talking about, for this particular instance, needing the blood, and Farrah knows some of my pet hypothesis about certain ET races, perhaps. Are we talking about they need the blood?
They need the blood, first of all, yes.
Because they need it to exist, or are they using it for experiments?
Maybe they need it for their own body system. Maybe human blood is their alimentation. Or maybe they need human and animal blood for their scientific experiments.
Now, Tom, you're the doctor of divinity here. That would make them demons, right? Or is that an objective, subjective term?
Well, it's a subjective term in the sense that all of these researchers I've already referred to, like Keel, Valet, Mack, you know, they drew the same conclusions. In fact, earlier when I mentioned Mack referring to these things being intermediaries from God or the devil, all of the best secular researchers, and one of the things that I did when I was doing my research, I tried to stay away, actually, from the people who were part of, let's say, the evangelical community or whatever, though I would, in many cases, consider myself to be part of their camp or the Catholic camp or whatever. But I tried to stay away from them because I felt that quoting them would subjugate my research to being skewed. And I didn't want to do that, so I actually used the best secular researchers, and every one of them, to a person, drew the same conclusions that whatever we were talking about here, at least in some cases, especially as it might relate to the alien grays, that we were talking about a phenomenon that was, if not identical, was at least comparable to historical demonology. That what people down through time had been reporting about these visitors who come in the nighttime, the incubus and succubus and other records. And they have, well, think about the incubus and succubus. What did they do? They came, they had an interest in actually collecting human sperm. And then they would use this later to impregnate a host, and then they would collect the offspring. I mean, isn't that identical to what...
That's the abduction story of today.
Yeah. And we're talking about history that goes back through thousands of years. In different religions, different ideas, people explaining Zeus coming down and he collects matter and he uses it with a woman, and then there is a giant that's born out of his relationship. The same kind of story is told in the Sumerian text, the Anunnaki, you know, the Zachariah Sitchin's whole record of the Anunnaki who came down. They blended themselves with humans, and they used some of them as slaves. Some of them were evil, some of them were good. This is a story that goes back to the beginning of time, and it's occurring as we speak right now. So, you know, Farrah's original question had to do with it being, what is it, metaphysical, or is it an advanced form of science? Well, we also have the CERN Stargate that's opened this week. Thankfully, so far, it hasn't destroyed the world. But this CERN Stargate is all about trying to find the Higgs boson, the God particle, the mystery of what holds all matter together. And they're also hoping that they're going to find proof of other dimensions.
The interesting thing is that this project, CERN project, is going to be completed in the next 4 years. So it is going to be completed in 2012 again. What is the secret of the 2012?
Isn't that interesting?
Let's follow that up, but I've got to take a break. 2012 coming up next, folks. Number one.
from the entertainment capital of the world, fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. It's Jerry Pippin with entertainment news, views, and interviews.
It's a great new season. Join us on VegasRadioShow.com as we bring the sizzle and the excitement of the world's most exciting city, Las Vegas. Vera Yudoza, you brought up 2012.
Yes, again, 2012. CERN project is going to be completed in the next 4 years. And
well, Tom, what do you think?
Well, do we want to talk about the year 2012, or do we want to talk about the CERN project? Because I know we don't have very much time.
I want to talk about it, but I want to both.
Well, you're probably going to have to look. You know, first of all, this CERN project. You know, I did a 3-hour. Radio show with somebody else this last week, and they were, and before CERN was ever turned on, they asked me if I thought it was going to suck us into a black hole, or these super strangelets were going to be released and consume us all, and I said no. It wasn't my belief that it would, but that this science is extraordinary, and could lead, it could actually just shatter our existing theories about physics. First of all, they're hoping, and there's a debate about whether they will, but they're hoping to find new particles such as the theoretical Higgs bosons, you know, the God particle, mm-hmm. Which is theorized to give mass to everything. But to me, what was more interesting was what we were talking about at the break, is that this CERN collider also pretends to prove the existence of unknown dimensions. And in doing so, these physicists are telling us that if they do, then they're going, it's going to kind of be like what Einstein did to physics in his day. I mean, it's going to alter our understanding of the universe as we know it. It could actually be the first baby step toward the discovery of the kind of dimensional reality that until now has only been speculated about in different theories and fictionalized in sci-fi movies like Star Trek, which you mentioned at the beginning of this show. That's, of course, if it doesn't destroy us all when it comes to full power. The other thing that I think, though, that is interesting...
You think, before you go any further, if it did destroy us all, would it be a chain reaction or instant?
Well, I think if it was going to happen, I don't think any of us have anything to worry about anyway, because it's going to be over so quick that we're not even going to know it happened. I don't believe that's going to happen, by the way. But I'm still interested in the project because... you know, like if you read my book, The Ahriman Gate, or even Nephilim Stargates, I talk about M-brains, and these are all based on real quantum physics, the idea that the third dimension, which we understand, isn't even the beginning. That there are, as far as quantum physicists know, and this based on, some of it based on tested theory, there are at least 10 dimensions. And maybe many more than that. And what CERN could potentially do is start introducing us to some of these other dimensions. Now, the other thing, though, that's interesting about CERN is this large statue of the Indian deity, Shiva Nataraja, which I think Farah mentioned earlier, which symbolizes the dance of creation and destruction.
Yes.
And of course, you know, those have been, there are those out there who were trying to stop the startup of the super collider. I mean, they saw the Shiva about to do the destruction side of his dance and were very concerned about it, because you got protons now that are going to be, they haven't done this part yet, but these things are going to be slammed together at a peak energy of 14 trillion electron volts all at one time. And this is, by the way, going to create black holes. They think that, you know, they'll diminish quickly. It could create these super atoms, the strangelets I referred to earlier. And that was part of these lawsuits where they believe that this thing could destroy the world. But while I didn't believe any of that was going to happen, I still don't, the dedication to Shiva does show that there could be a spiritual side too, or a metaphysical, if you want to use that term, to what's going on there at CERN. And you know, there are some people that I don't know if you saw this, there were some who were questioning the design of the official logo of CERN, which they thought showed the beastly number 666? Did you see
any
of others who were connecting it to Sir Nunos, you know, the horned deity of the ancient Celts and Gauls? Which, by the way, later on became Pan, which is interesting if you think of Pan dimensional. But they were connecting it to Pandemonium, which in mythology was to unleash a frenzy of demons. One of the more interesting things about this, the abbreviation for the Hadron Collider, which is HC, which in Hebrew means a gate or a gateway. But even if none of that means anything, this dance of Shiva Nataraja that destroys at the atomic level and then rebuilds from the atomic level upward, this is intriguing, isn't it, Farah?
It's extremely, yes.
That you have this metaphor that is encoded at CERN through this statue, because I'm sure that most of your audience understands that all of creation, including intelligent living species, obviously humans whose bodies are temples of their souls and spirits, all of this is made up of these same atomic particles that they're experimenting with there, protons, neutrons surrounded by spinning electrons that form different molecules of different density, so that molecules which make up our body are different than the densities that make up a tree. And we're talking about something here now, an invention, a stargate, if you will, that could take us to a deeper understanding of how atomic energy occurs than what we've ever understood before. It might bring us to a new understanding of who we are as a species. It might also have something to do with realigning what we are as a
species.
Well,
and you talk about that, and we're not that far from 2012, so that's the reason I said we need to discuss both of them. You think the Mayan calendar has anything to do with anything?
Yeah, I do.
What?
I wrote an article. When is this show going to broadcast?
This coming week.
Okay, well, that'll be fine then. I wrote an article just for WorldNet Daily today that'll be published by them as an exclusive on Monday.
Well, this show will be coming out Monday evening or Tuesday.
Well, good then, because I have to make sure that when I do an
Right. No, it won't come up before.
These gods of Middle America, the Aztecs, the Mayan deities, such as Quetzalcoatl, and whether the end of their long calendar and the return of their chief god Quetzalcoatl, according to the mythology in 2012, corresponds with ancient Eastern biblical prophecies, other prophecies around the world, or belief systems around the world, for that matter, even the return of the Watchers, the giants, my title, the year 2012 and the return of the Watchers. The thing about all of that is that you have these very intriguing pieces of symbolism, Jerry. Among the legends of these multidimensional beings in Mayan belief, there was this methodology that existed whereby they believed that in some cases, Quetzalcoatl, their other gods, could move from behind or through gateways. Now, sometimes this meant through statues, through persons, but sometimes it meant descending down out of the heavens or out of the Ouroboros. And this is chiseled in their stone. It also included them coming down in winged discs, if you will, among these sky locations in the Earth's reality. So what's interesting about the year 2012 is, I'm trying to think how to say all this in like the next 5 minutes. You have the ecliptic, the pathway of the sun, which crosses the Milky Way. And their ancient descriptions depict the distance between those points as a snake called the Ouroboros, or the tail devourer. Now, it wasn't just the Mayans that showed that. That was in Aztec, Chinese, Native American mythologies. The symbolism about the mouth of a snake swallowing its own tail. And many people believe that this is very symbolic of the idea of a stargate. In Mayan mythology, sometimes Quetzalcoatl is actually viewed as being the Ouroboros in Aztec and Toltec ruins, but sometimes he's being viewed as coming out of the Ouroboros, which is prophesied to happen in the year 2012. Now, some of their renderings show a ladder descending down out of the ecliptic, and so he descends down you know, out of the mouth of the Ouroboros on ladder. But this is prophesied to happen in the year 2012, the end of times, the reopening, if you will, of this serpent portal, the end of the great cycle of the Mayan calendar and the planetary cycle of the Aztec calendar, December 21, the year 2012. There's a lot of other prophecies that say that the Earth is going to come to an end and all that, but the Maya don't believe that. They describe these past visits of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, and they believe when he comes back this time, it's actually just going to signal the beginning of a new era. Is that correct, Farah?
Yes. In fact, if we had time, I was going to ask you a couple of questions about...
Go ahead. We can go a couple of minutes
okay.
over because we're editing this.
Air snake. The snake which comes from the air, the snake which has the ability of flying. So all this information repeats itself, but it, at the same time, it explains, one step explains the other step. So talking about, for instance, again, your book, Stargate, there are some passages about my country, Turkey, Pergamum, and the power of the snake symbolism in Pergamum in Asclepius. Isn't it interesting?
Yes. Well, there again, you know, the repetition between this idea about serpent technology or the serpent god turns up over and over again throughout various different mythology. And it's very easy to relate this symbolism to the idea that it was encodified in the astrological symbols, in the stars or in the sky, and the fact that you had different religions at different times who encodified it in the same way makes you wonder then, you know, what the Mayans may have known about their version of the Ouroboros and their depiction of this serpent, circular serpent, star system that was going to come to an end in the year 2012, that the serpent rope is going to emerge again from the center of the Milky Way, and that Quetzalcoatl is going to return to mark the end of our age and the beginning of another age. The part of the book that you're talking about, my book, Nephilim Stargates, the sixth chapter.
Yeah, that chapter was actually written by David Flynn, right? Farah knows him. Wrote something about the occult in Roswell, didn't he, Farah?
I know very well that article. I read it. I know.
And it was the most extraordinary article. I mean, and he talked about how the year 2012, even the landing site at Roswell, even the Mount of Horeb upon which these watchers, these gods we started talking about at the beginning of the show, came down, and even the year 1776, the founding of this country.
Yeah, he ties all that together for 2012.
You know that 33.33 is a very important number. Those same degrees of the Great Circle of the Earth are exactly 2,012 nautical miles. And David showed how that Mount Hermon in Phoenicia, the location of the extraterrestrial influence that first came down, the watchers, if you will, who came down the first time with man, it lies at precisely 33.33 degrees north, 33.33 degrees east, exactly 2,012 miles from the equator and 2,012 miles from the prime meridian. It's the most extraordinary research, and the only other place on Earth where these numbers all match in the same way is the exact location of the crash site of the UFO in Roswell, New Mexico. The point was about all of it that perhaps those who came down the first time were leaving us some kind of a marker on Earth so that we would know when they were going to come back the second time.
Tom and Farah, we're out of time almost completely. Clock has got us. Thanks for listening, everyone. This has been the Parazone Hour. Good night.